WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill.
From Silver Hollow Audio and Radio Catskill, this is Cats Cast. I'm Brett Barry, and each week we bring you stories and conversations rooted right here in our mountains and valleys. Local culture, history, sustainability, nature, literature, and the arts, and lots more. Coming up, warm autumnal days can be delightful, but what about those ticks? Dr. Saravanan Tangamani runs the Tangamani Lab at Upstate Medical University, where ticks are collected and studied.
All of us are focused on Lyme disease, but I think, as I said, in the rearview mirror, we are actually starting to see something else is coming, and we had to be proactive. And I think that the research that we do in the lab, in a way, is helping to monitor that, right? So when we continuously monitor, we can detect the emergence of these viruses before they become a problem in the humans.
Tick-tock. It's time for Tick Tech. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. As of today, there is no money for millions of people who rely on SNAP, the federal food assistance program. President Trump cites the government shutdown now in its 32nd day. Two federal judges have ruled that stopping payments is unlawful. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has more.
They said Congress has provided more than $5 billion in emergency funds, and it's for exactly this kind of situation. They rejected the administration's argument that it cannot legally use that. They said it not only can, but must. In Rhode Island, Judge John McConnell Jr. called for this to happen as soon as possible. The other judge, Indira Talwani in Boston, said officials could also tap more money from customs revenue, but she left that decision up to them.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden reporting. President Trump posted on social media last night that if given the appropriate legal direction from the courts, it would be his honor to provide the money. The government shutdown also affects a program that helps millions of households pay their home heating bills. In normal years, billions of dollars are dispersed to states by October or November. While benefits should kick in today, it's unclear when or if that assistance will become available. From member station WBUR, Miriam Wasser reports.
The Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, better known as LIHEAP, helps more than 6 million households in the country. But this year, with no federal spending bill in place, states are entering the winter heating season without new funding. Mark Wolf leads the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, a group that represents state agencies that administer LIHEAP.
People won't turn on their furnace. They'll be afraid of the bill. This has happened before. People die. They end up in hospitals. These programs not only help people pay their bills, but it helps them thrive.
Wolf says some states have a little money left over from last year, but it's not enough to help everyone. For NPR News, I'm Miriam Wasser in Boston.
A bipartisan panel voted unanimously yesterday to pass a new map in Ohio. The state will now avoid a lengthier fight over the required redrawing of boundaries. Ohio Public Media's Sarah Donaldson has more in the story.
Ohio's new map moves Cincinnati and Toledo's districts in Congress further right, but Akron inches left, and it makes some already Republican-friendly districts even friendlier. But Democratic Representative Dunny Isaacson of Cincinnati says it staved off a worst-case map for the minority party.
They tried to steal districts here, like they were doing in Texas, North Carolina, and Missouri, and today we prevented that from happening.
He and the other Democratic lawmakers who voted for the map shut the door on any effort to repeal it. Still, both sides are facing blowback for the deal, since at least one of those now Republican seats could swing the other way. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Donaldson in Columbus.
This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. All New Yorkers will vote on an Adirondack-related ballot question this election. Proposition 1 appears on the back of every ballot. From the New York Public News Network, North Country Public Radio's Emily Russell explains.
To understand how Prop 1 ended up on the ballot in this election, we have to go back about 5 years. Lake Placid was getting ready to host the World University Games. That's when Dave Gibson and other environmentalists noticed something he says was alarming.
Many people who pass by the Mount Van Hoffenberg access road just outside the village of Lake Placid saw a pile of logs.
Gibson is the executive director of Adirondack Wild. Here's why the pile of logs raised alarm bells. Article 14 of the New York State Constitution, known as the Forever Wild Clause, strictly prohibits tree cutting on state forest preserve. While a portion of the Olympic site is on town-owned land, most of it is on forest preserve.
Those of us who were curious, where are these logs coming from, found out that they're coming from lands that are on the forest preserve.
So essentially, the Olympic Regional Development Authority, which operates Mount Van Hovenberg, was violating the state's constitution when it cut down all those trees. Here's what Prop 1 would do. It would make an exception for the tree cutting and development that's already happened. Prop 1 also includes a land deal. If it's approved, the state would be required to protect an additional 2,500 acres in the Adirondacks. All of the top green groups in the park support Prop 1. Early voting is underway in New York. Election Day is this coming Tuesday. I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
If a tick bites you in the woods and it's free of disease-causing pathogens, does it matter? In 2022, I sent six ticks from the Central Catskills to the Tangamani Lab at Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, where they were tested not just for Lyme disease-causing bacteria, but 16 additional pathogens ticks can carry. Following is my conversation with Dr. Saravanan Tangamani about the results of those tests and what it means for our region. Later, we reconnect with Dr. Tangamani to see how our tick landscape has changed in 2025 and what we can expect looking forward. I'm Brett Barry, and this is CatsCast.
My name is Saravanan Tangamani. I'm a professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the SUNY Upstate Medical University. I'm a vector-borne disease researcher and also a virologist. What that means is that any disease that are caused by mosquitoes and ticks. My lab primarily focuses on the viral diseases like chikungunya virus, Zika virus, West Nile virus transmitted by mosquitoes. And on the tick side, I'm interested in Powassan virus, which is kind of endemic to New York State and northeastern United States.
We'll talk about Powassan virus later in the show. It's a scary one. But most tick-borne pathogens in our region are bacterial and the cause of Lyme disease and anaplasmosis, which can cause fever, headache, chills, and worse. Catskills ticks can also carry a parasitic pathogen, causing babesiosis. None of these are good. When Dr. Saravanan Tangamani moved from Houston, Texas to Syracuse, New York, his research shifted from mosquito-borne diseases to tick-borne diseases.
Because, you know, I'm coming from mosquito disease area to a tick disease area. So my interest kind of shifted more to the tick-borne disease area. Along with that, my interest in Lyme disease got increased as well. So that's the only bacterial pathogen the lab is interested in. Everything else, we work only with viruses. Very first project that we did after coming to Syracuse is to identify where Powassan virus positive ticks are present in the state of New York. So basically, we want to identify where they are. If I go to my yard and I collect the ticks and test them, one third of the ticks will be positive for the Lyme disease agent. However, it's not the same for viruses, or it's not the same for other tick-borne agents. So we went to public lands, state parks, city parks, to collect the ticks and test them for the viruses. That's how we started initially. But soon we realized that it is difficult for us because New York State is big. So we decided that, okay, instead of us going to every single place, why don't we ask the public to send the tick to us, and then we test them for all the agents, including the viruses and the Lyme disease agent. We originally started for Central New York, just, you know, because we were so focused on where we are. We got a very good support from the public, and, you know, a lot of people wanted to send the ticks to my lab. So we decided, okay, let's expand to upstate New York. Within a week, then we have to expand it to the entire state of New York because of the outpouring support we got from the public and how many people actually were encountering the tick and they want to get it tested. So it is a synergistic effort. The data that we are collecting is good for my research. And the data that I'm providing the public is good for them because they get to know what is in the tick. So it is a win-win solution. And it's a perfect community academic partnership. You know, it's like that's how citizen science are being done. So we've been doing this for nearly 3 years now. And we have also developed a dashboard, a tick map, we call it, where we actually upload the data in real time. So anyone with internet access can actually find where are the Lyme disease agent positive ticks are there, where are the Powassan virus ticks are there in a county level. It's an interactive tool. And I know that public are using, clinicians are using, policymakers are using, and researchers are using. So it is now I'm calling this as a public health tool to track the emergence of ticks and tick-borne agents in the state of New York.
Will you continue to accept ticks indefinitely? Is there an end date or a goal?
I wouldn't say indefinitely because it's all about the funding for the program. I started this program with my discretionary money to begin with because it was supposed to feed research data to me. So I invested in that. We didn't realize that it will actually evolve into a major program. I never envisioned that. It was not in my plan at all. My plan was to identify the hotspots for Powassan virus and then do further investigation in that hotspot, and my research is done. But because of the way how community reacted to that, because of the way how support I was getting all the support, I realized that our research means more than what I thought. So that's why we decided to kind of expand our program, continue to provide it. So right now, our university is supporting this program. Definitely, they are not going to support indefinitely. So we are reaching out to every single source to get funding. It all depends on the funding. If I have funding, I will do it perpetually. We do collect funds from the public as well. But again, at the end of the day, the bottom line is if we have funding, we'll be able to do it.
So a New Yorker finds a tick, puts it in a Ziploc bag with a moist paper towel to keep it hydrated, which is important to the research, and being able to test the tick when it arrives. Can you explain how you analyze the ticks when they arrive?
When the public in New York State or when someone comes to New York State encounter a tick, obviously I tell the people, when you go trekking or do outdoor activity, as soon as you come back home, test for the tick, do a tick check. And then when they find a tick, they pull it out, put it in a Ziploc bag with a moist paper towel, and then go to nyticks.org, complete the tick submission form. And once you complete the tick submission form, a unique tick ID will be provided. And then I ask the public to actually write that unique tick ID on the Ziploc bag and then send it to the lab in a bubble wrap. So the reason, there are two things. One, bubble wrap preserves the tick so it doesn't get squished when it goes through the postal scanners. Or you have to write a not scannable on it. Otherwise, it will go through the machine scanner and that will squish the tick. And if it is fed, it will actually release the blood into the tissue paper and it will mold will grow and it will be nasty. So that's why we tell people to put in the bubble wrap. The moist tissue allows the tick, as you mentioned, it keeps the tick hydrated, keeps the tick fresh. You remove the moisture from the environment, ticks will die right away. The reason why we want is that we use the tick to identify what agents they are. Also, we save half of the tick material for future research purposes, like isolating new Borrelia, isolating new virus. For that, we need to preserve them in a good condition. Otherwise, we will not be able to isolate them. We will not be able to culture them. So that's why I'm asking them to put it in a tissue, like moist tissue. So every day around noon, big postal box will be delivered to my lab and we then take them and we open the bubble wrap. And then the Ziploc bag will be removed from the bubble wrap and we will look for the tick ID on them. And then we type in that particular number. It will pull all the information that the submitter has submitted. We then look the tick under the microscope, identify them, and then wash them. Because ticks are, dirty. They can have a lot of contamination. So we surface sterilize the tick and then we transfer the tick into a special cocktail mixture. And then we take it to a tissue homogenizer. So we put two BB beads, like two metal beads, same size as BB gun beads, for each tick in a small vial. And then that tissue homogenizer shakes vigorously for 5 minutes. What happens is that these BB beats and, you know, ticks got mixed together, it will macerate the tick into millions of pieces. That allows all the biological material to get released into the special cocktail that we have. Then we remove the BB beats, and then that biological content that is now called homogenized material will be used for nucleic acid extraction. Once the nucleic acids are extracted, we then use our special assay that is developed in the lab to detect 17 tick-borne agents that are commonly present in the state of New York. Combining the user-submitted data and the lab-collected data, together we are collecting at the minimum 43 sets of data for each tick. So those 43 sets of data are now put into the tick dashboard. So that's what people see, the public dashboard is. We kind of incorporate all those data. Obviously, we don't present all 43 sets of data because of privacy concerns. So we go up to the county level. We don't go beyond to the zip level. But the zip code level data, I'm providing to county health people or city health people because they can use that information to make informed decision on tick control, tick education, and also deer management if that is needed.
You know, maybe I have a short memory, but I don't remember ticks being a major problem when I was a kid. Were there less of them or were pathogens less widespread?
No, there were less ticks as well. As population grows, we invade, we try to build our community in the woods and forests. And so technically, you know, from urban center, we are slowly starting to move to rural center, or we are converting the rural environment into an urban environment, which means that now we are living amongst the deer. We are living amongst the deer mice. We are living amongst the groundhogs, which means that they carry the ticks. So we are coming closer to the ticks. I see deer almost every day that crosses my yard. I see groundhogs in my yard. I see deer mice. They carry the ticks and they drop the ticks wherever they go. And tick-borne pathogens also emerge along the way, but emergence of tick-borne pathogen, there are multiple factors that play a role. And that's the one reason why we started this program, is to understand what factors influence the pathogen emergence and what makes a particular, you know, let's say neighborhood so unique that it has. Like, I would say that, you know, you're from Catskills, the lower Hudson Valley, that's a hotbed for tick-borne diseases. You have Lyme disease there, you have Powassan virus there, you have Anaplasma there, you have Babesia there. And there are two new ticks that are emerging there as well, the Lone Star ticks and the Asian Longhorn tick that was recently identified in the United States. And they are slowly kind of marching from tri-state area to the Catskills, to the lower Hudson Valley, and then they will move all the way to the northern, what is it, Adirondacks and central New York and western New York. So that's the pattern we are seeing. So that is something that we can monitor this emergence over a period of time in real time.
Is climate change leading to their migration north?
Definitely climate change is influencing the migration of animals and migration of small animals particularly, because that helps the ticks to perpetuate. Because the ticks like to feed on the small mammals and also on the deer. Adults feed on the deer, smaller stages like larvae and nymphs, they feed on deer, mice, and small mammals.
Why are ticks so good at spreading disease?
Ticks are very hardy. They can survive any harsh weather. The only thing that they can't survive is dry condition. They need a little bit of moisture, and they can live for a long period of the time without taking a food. When adults feed on a deer, they lay eggs. 5,000 eggs, minimum, 5,000 eggs. One female infected with Powassan virus can lay eggs for 5,000 larvae, and 90% of the larvae will be positive for the virus. And also, every single life stage of the tick, it needs to feed on a mammal, either a mouse or a fox or a squirrel or a groundhog or a deer. It has to come in contact with an animal. As we all know from COVID, wild animals carry lots of diseases. Human-wildlife interaction allows the transfer of, you know, zoonotic agents to humans. And once the tick acquires a pathogen, it stays with it for entire life, which means that if a larvae acquires a pathogen, it will feed, it will mold to become nymph, and the nymph will be positive for the agent. It will feed and become adult, and the adult will be positive. So you have more chance of encountering a tick that has a pathogen.
So according to the maps that you have on your site, New York State has 15 distinct species of ticks. I knew about, you know, a couple.
Not all of them are, you know, highly dangerous to humans, but I can tell that the like deer ticks, obviously everybody's know about it, that carry Lyme disease and seven other agents. And dog ticks are emerging, and Lone Star ticks. Lone Star ticks at this time, 90% of them are in Suffolk County and Manhattan, New York City counties. However, they are slowly, you know, we are starting to see Lone Star ticks coming in central New York as well. But it in the next few years, it will happen here. And the Asian longhorn tick, that is emerging as well. In addition to that, we recently, together with our collaborators in New York City, we identified an established population of Gulf Coast tick. Traditionally, you know, as the name suggests, Gulf Coast tick, normally they are present only in the Gulf Coast of the United States, like Louisiana, Arkansas, you know, Texas, in that area. But we saw an established population in Staten Island. We published that, and they carry another disease. Deer ticks, dog ticks, Lone Star ticks, Asian longhorn tick, and the Gulf Coast tick. These are the five major tick of public health importance in the New York State.
To date, as of this conversation, you've tested 19,601 ticks. 34.7% had a pathogen of some kind.
Exactly. So that's more than one third of a tick, right, is positive. Again, we are normalizing to the entire state of New York. So if you use a map and click Onondaga County, maybe 40%. You go to Dutchess County, it may be 50%. You go to Suffolk County, it's less because we get most of the Lone Star ticks from there. So every county is different. And also even within the county, even every neighborhood is different. I can tell exactly which zip code has the highest risk for Lyme disease agent ticks. And that's the information I give it to the county. That's the information I give it to public health. So they know exactly which area that they have to target for tick education, control, and deer management. You know, I know not every county approves deer management, but that could be, you know, that if someone wants to use it, that data is available for them.
So let's get to the part we've all been waiting for here, the unveiling of the results of the six ticks that I sent to your lab, and maybe you can shed some light on what all of this means. So tick 23059 was D. variabilis.
Yeah, that's a dog tick.
Female, and she was negative.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing, because that's the one that was on my wife's scalp. The other ones I collected from outside by dragging a white t-shirt through the leaves. So the next was D. variabilis, dog tick, female, negative. Third tick, it's a male deer tick, and it tested positive for
Borrelia burgdorferi, that's the Lyme disease-causing agent.
Next tick I picked up was also a deer tick, female, positive for the Lyme disease agent. Tick 23063, deer tick, female, positive for anaplasma.
So that causes anaplasmosis.
Okay.
So the tick that you sent us, you know, half of them are dog ticks that tested negative for all the agents we tested. And the deer tick that you sent, all three of them carry some disease-causing agent. Two of them had Lyme disease agent. The other one had anaplasma agent. There are three major tick-borne diseases that are currently, you know, of human health importance in the New York State: Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, and babesiosis. And you had two of them. But again, the one thing that I want to kind of put the disclaimer is that just because the tick were positive, it doesn't mean that they may have transmitted the agent to you. It doesn't mean that you will get sick. This is an information. You can then relay that to your clinician. The clinician can make an informed decision based on that. Because it depends on how long a tick is feeding on a human. That makes a big difference. If it is just crawling, it's like nothing. You don't have to worry about it. But if it is embedded in your skin, it depends on how long it was attached to it. Like anaplasma, anywhere from 12 to 24 hours, it will transmit the agent. Borrelia, sometime between, I would say, 24 to 48. But viruses are transmitted right away, immediately upon attachment.
And this is where we cue the scary music.
If your deer tick had a Powassan virus, and if it was attached on your skin, even for 1 hour, it would have transmitted the virus. And also, it's a fatal agent. So which means that 15 to 20% of the people who receive this agent from the tick will succumb to the disease. The second worst part is 50% of the survivors will have long-term neurological sequelae like loss of consciousness, difficulty, walking difficulty, and like a slurred speech. It's very similar to Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. It's rare, but it's a highly dangerous disease to get. But would you get sick? That depends on individual person's health. You know, someone has stronger immune system, so they will, you know, our immune system will react to that little bit of virus that is being delivered to the human. But let's assume a tick that is positive of virus and it stays attached for 4 or 5 days. 4 or 5 days, it is constantly injecting the virus. So which means that your inoculum of the virus is so high that could actually lead to symptomatic disease. But again, every human immune system is different. That is one thing that a lot of diseases are asymptomatic, is that, you know, the way how our body reacts to that.
Powassan virus has made it to Ulster County, but Dr. Tangamani assured me it is still very rare. This being citizen science, when I was dragging the t-shirt along the ground, I did pick up a tiny spider, and at first I thought it was a tick because it was so small, and then I looked closer and saw that it was a spider, so I released it and it kept going. But when you go to the tick map for the state, the fifth most popular tick is labeled not a tick. So does that make you laugh when those come in?
Not really, but I feel sorry for them, because sometimes people yank their mole thinking it's a tick.
Oof.
Or sometimes they actually send a dry skin scab thinking it's a tick. And sometimes skin tissue.
Wow.
The other cluster is like beetles, spiders. Also, even sometimes we receive ants. So we have a bunch of things, but I feel sorry for those that sends their mole, yanking a mole and sending a piece of skin. Oh, that must be painful for them. People are scared, and I think that's one reason why they go to that extent to yank their mole thinking it's a tick. The education need to be there. People need to be told how to recognize a tick and how to pull it gently so that they don't have to yank their mole or skin, right? So it's a process of educating it, and we are working with the Lyme disease advocacy organization, not-for-profit organizations, to do education and, you know, how to recognize it and how not to have tick bites. I think that's the most important, right? How not to have tick bites.
I explained to Dr. Tangamani that the dog and deer ticks I harvested from our property all came from the leafy edges, nothing from the grass itself.
I think that's a perfect observation. That's where I tell people to be careful. That's the perfect ecotone where, you know, a clean mowed grass meets unmowed path. And that's where most of the, you know, like wildlife will be crawling, because that's a perfect place for them. Mm-hmm. Landscape management will, you know, help. It will go half the way to control the ticks, actually. So now you know the ticks that are in your property. There are two types of ticks. You have dog ticks and deer ticks. And 100% of your deer ticks carry some pathogen. If you continue to send the tick to us, you have your own ecology data. You have your own data for your own neighborhood or your property, right? So this gives us an information to the public. Sometimes what people told me is that they get the results and they realize that, oh, they need to do landscape a little bit different so that they try to avoid deer walking through their property. Or they try to, you know, CDC has an excellent guidebook on how to design a landscape in such a way that you limit your contact with the ticks. So they actually take proactive measures to redesign the landscape in such a way that avoid all the wildlife coming through their property. So we are changing the people's behavior. And if it is attached to someone's body, they can always consult with their healthcare provider. Unfortunately, you know, we are not a clinical laboratory, so I clearly tell them that we can't advise anybody on healthcare solutions. So I tell them, contact your clinician. It is a warning system. It's an advanced warning system for them to be proactively try to do, you know, tick prevention measures in their property, tick check every time when they come inside. It is just to give them information about the risk of ticks. Like any other disease, it is very important to get access to healthcare solutions as quickly as possible. Because if you identify or if you detect a particular disease at the early stage, it's very easy to take antibiotics or any other, you know, control methods. But if it can't be detected early, then it's very difficult, because that becomes, you know, chronic, a lot of other complications that comes out of Lyme disease. So it's very important to identify this as early as possible. And we are just a tool in that process.
What should every Catskiller know about our tick populations?
You know, I would encourage people to learn more about the ticks, to learn more about how you can avoid tick bites, how you can properly landscape your property in such a way that you can avoid any tick encounters. We can do all the best, but still we can encounter the tick. So if you encounter a tick, take the tick, go to our website, learn how to send a tick and send it to us. We'll test it for free. Then you can use that data for your informed decision-making process, either to landscape management or share the data with your healthcare provider for expedited healthcare solutions. It's a tool, so that can they can take advantage of the tool. So be tick aware. That's what I would say. Catskills has a lot of ticks, and be tick aware. That's all I can tell.
And finally, do you have any positive news on the tick-borne disease front? Anything coming out of the research that suggests that we may have a better time of dealing with this in the future?
I think we are working on developing a vaccine. There's a couple of Lyme disease vaccines are in phase 3 clinical trials. So I think there's a lot of good news in that front. And definitely the technology that was used to develop COVID vaccine, now we are adopting that technology for other tick-borne disease as well. So I think, you know, in the coming years, 3 to 5 years, I think we will have some good news about vaccines for tick-borne diseases. And also a lot of researchers working on developing diagnostic methods that are more accurate, that can detect the Lyme disease at the earliest stage in the best possible way. So diagnostics and healthcare, like vaccine development, are going on at high speed. In about 3 to 5 years, we'll have both of these things available for everyone to gain access to that.
When we come back, Dr. Tongamani addresses funding challenges, improved and expanded testing, and the emergence of new ticks in our region. I'm Brett Barry, and this is Cat's Cast. We'll be right back.
Oh, trick-or-treaters.
Get the candy.
Trick-or-treat.
Look at these costumes. We've got a vampire.
And a witch.
And what are you?
Oh, I'm an apple pie.
Ah!
Radio Catskill has more tasty terror than you've ever seen at Apple Pie Paloozaween.
That sounds like a lot of pie.
A frightful amount of apple pie.
Ah!
There's pie to eat, pie to buy, for ghouls and gourmets alike. You're sure to savor every bootiful bite.
That pun was kind of scary.
It sure was.
Apple Pie Paloozaween. Frightfully good fun to support Radio Catskill. 2 to 5 this afternoon. Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Happy Apple Pie Paloozaween.
It's all right if you wear a costume, too.
You're listening to Cat's Cast. I'm Brett Barry, and we're back with Dr. Saravanan Tongamani. Dr. Tongamani, thank you for joining me again. It's great to see you, and looking forward to following up on our previous conversation from a few years back.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm more than happy to join this show, and happy to share what we are doing and happy to share what we are finding. And maybe I can, you know, share some of the crystal ball information I have as well.
Yeah, I think we would all be interested in that. So what's new at the tick lab? I see that ticks are still being accepted for testing, but there's a fee associated with it now. So what's happened with that program?
3 years back when we talked, I think at that time, we were offering the tick testing for free. We had institutional support, my discretionary funding, and some other fundings. We were pooling money from different sources. So I was able to do free tick testing for the New York's residents. But, you know, as they say, every pot has a finite number. And we have reached to a point that where we couldn't offer any more free testing. So we took a break for a year to come up with a plan on what is the best way to run this program, at the same time, keep it more affordable for the public. So we decided to kind of charge a basic fee. We are a state university, and you know, we are not a profit-making entity anyway. So we decided to come up with a budget just to cover operational cost, and then offer at a very nominal price. But our quality professionalism is exactly the same. And for the year of 2025, what we are doing is we have a 3-tier testing option for the residents. So they can just pay like $10 just to get the tick tested for the Lyme disease agent Borrelia. It's only $10 for the Onondaga County residents. And if you want to check for the three most common things that are the Borrelia, Anaplasma, and Babesia, it's $20. But if you want to check the comprehensive, all 16, it's $40. So the price that I mentioned, they are for the Onondaga County residents because we do have a collaborative agreement with the county to offer the tick testing at a very subsidized fee. So for the others, anybody outside Onondaga County, it's double the price. So still it's affordable. You know what is the risk in the tick and you can, it gives you peace of mind. And also you can take that information to your healthcare provider and evaluate the risk of exposure.
Okay, so submitting ticks from Onondaga County is subsidized, so a little bit less.
Yes.
But anyone in New York State can send in the ticks and just follow that fee schedule.
Exactly. And because we now are a fee, we are charging fee, we decided to open up the entire, to the entire United States because, I need to get more ticks so that I can keep the price low as well, right? So we decided to open up for the entire United States. But we are, trying to reach out to other county health departments or state health departments. I'm hoping to emulate this same collaborative agreement with other counties and states as well.
Are the results quick enough if you're concerned about health, or is it more for a citizen science aspect?
There is a citizen science component to it because the data is being used to develop the dashboard, the tick map dashboard that anyone can use it. So the data that we are collecting through this program eventually ends up there, but that doesn't compromise our time in anything. So from the time that we receive the ticks in the lab, we process and send the results within 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
But officially, I'm telling 2 to 3 business days.
Right.
But I know in the lab, we take every single measure to send the results as soon as possible. And our self-impacted deadline for us is 24 hours from the time we receive it. But officially, because now we are charging, we don't want anyone will sue us for being late. So we actually call it 2 to 3 days. And the idea is that they will take the results to the clinical healthcare provider and seek expedited healthcare solutions. So I still want to keep that as my core component of helping the community at a very affordable pricing option. Yes, we use the data, we have the data, and then I put the data for epidemiological purposes that any public can use it, health departments can use it, and clinicians, they can use it as well.
Yeah, that's great. So how has the New York State tick landscape changed since we last spoke in 2022? Are there any new trends or things that you're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. It's a great question. So that is something that I'm really I wouldn't say excited. As a scientist, I'm excited when things happen, but I know that from a public perspective, it's different. So I'm sorry to come off that way.
Yeah.
But yes, since the time we spoke, I think dog ticks and Lone Star ticks are now emerging in big waves in New York State, particularly in the central New York, western New York. I can guarantee that. Because when we spoke last time, deer ticks was still the primary tick of importance, followed by minimally dog ticks and Lone Star ticks. The Lone Star ticks are primarily present at that time in the Suffolk County area, Long Island. But now we are seeing Lone Star tick submissions throughout the state. Dog ticks, it's almost throughout the state. So these two ticks are now actually emerging big waves throughout the New York state. That doesn't mean that deer ticks are not emerging, but deer ticks continue to emerge. But because they were already in so high numbers, we don't see the trend alarmingly, but they are continuing to increase. But the alarming trend is the Lone Star ticks and the dog ticks continue to emerge. That's one important thing. Second thing is the Asian longhorn tick that is a recently introduced tick in the United States is also slowly increasing in numbers. And the third one is another tick called Gulf Coast tick or Amblyomma maculata. That, as the name suggests, traditionally it is in the Gulf Coast, United States, but we are starting to see that tick in the Staten Island, in New York State, Suffolk County area as well. So I would say that the landscape has changed a lot since we last discussed. The important thing is, although I say that the ticks are increasing in its geographic range, along with that, they carry pathogens, which means that they are also expanding its geographic range. Wherever the ticks goes, they actually bring the pathogen with them. So this is a true public health risk. In addition to deer ticks, in addition to Lyme disease, we have other tick-borne disease problems that are slowly coming, in the rearview mirror that we should be watchful for.
what kind of pathogens are these three ticks bringing with them?
So the Lone Star ticks transmit Ehrlichia, and also it can transmit a couple of viruses called Heartland virus and Bourbon virus, for which we don't have any treatment. And it's rare, but I think it can be fatal in, you know, immunocompromised patients. In addition to that, the bites of Lone Star ticks can cause alpha-gal allergy, right? That actually makes the people not wanting to eat meat. So that's in addition to pathogen, the immunological disease is also a problem for Lone Star ticks, right? That's a Lone Star tick. The Asian longhorn tick is known to transmit multiple pathogens, including a virus that has a case fatality rate of 20%. But the good news is that none of the ticks from the United States are known to carry that, which means that so far, all the ticks are negative for the virus. But in China, Japan, Korea, these ticks carry this very dangerous virus called SFTS virus, or severe thrombocytopenia syndrome-like virus. It's a mouthful, but it is actually a virus in the family Bunyavirus, and it actually can cause severe human illness. As I said, 20% case fatality. And this is one of the primary tick-borne virus of human health importance in Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Korea. But luckily, so far, we have not found these ticks to carry this virus. But again, as with any other disease, it is just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. So we need to continuously monitor for the emergence of these new viruses, ticks and tick-borne pathogens in the United States. So this is a cause of concern, actually, in my opinion, that, you know, all of us are focused on Lyme disease. But I think, as I said, in the rearview mirror, we are actually starting to see something else is coming, and we had to be proactive. And I think that the research that we do in the lab, like the Citizens and Tick Testing Program, in a way is helping to monitor that, right? So when we continuously monitor, we can detect the emergence of these viruses before they become a problem in the humans. So I think the program that we do, it's really helpful. And that's one thing that I'm trying to keep this program going. No matter how difficult the time is going to be with the funding, we're going to continue to do it, because for the larger good of the community, for the larger good of the epidemiology world, our work is really, really important.
As I told you in an email, my dad is being treated at this very moment for suspected anaplasmosis, but it takes weeks for those blood tests to confirm that. When I take the dogs to the vet, the test for anaplasmosis takes about 10 minutes. So I don't know if you can answer this, but why are we so much better at diagnosing and treating our pets? Do you think there's something to be said about our own healthcare system in this regard?
Anaplasma that infects the dogs are a little different species than the ones that infect the humans. That's one thing.
Okay.
Right? There's a lot of genetic diversity amongst the pathogen that infect humans that becomes a little more difficult. And the most important thing, I think that in my opinion, the standards for the humans are much, much higher because we don't want to give false positive or false negative, right? I think that there is some sort of a leniency when it comes to the pets.
Right.
That even if there is a slight indication that there is a positive, I think test will call it positive, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with humans, we have to be certain. Otherwise, people will sue for wrongful treatment.
Right.
So I think there is a lot of repercussions if something is false positive, false negative. So we have to be careful. Also, the pathogen-wise, they are genetically different. They are genetically divergent. And there are many variants of a single pathogen that is circulating. So that becomes very difficult to diagnose. Same goes with the Borrelia as well. So I must tell that when you are asking about what are the changes, I kind of focus primarily on the ticks. But I must tell that within the deer tick world, in addition to Lyme disease, there are two additional diseases that are emerging, particularly this year. One is Anaplasma. The other one is Babesia. And Lyme disease continues to march on. You know, there is a small increase in every year. But these two pathogens are Anaplasma phagocytophilum, Babesia microti. The rate of prevalence in the ticks that we test are really high compared to previous years. Also, my conversation with my colleagues at the University Hospital and other places, they are seeing more human patients, human cases with anaplasmas. So what we find in the ticks is what they find in the clinic as well. And I believe that the trend is going to continue, that in the coming years, we will see more anaplasmosis and babesiosis cases in addition to Lyme disease.
How do those stack up in terms of the danger to a human to Lyme disease?
Actually, it will make worse because, you know, a single deer tick can now transmit multiple pathogens, right?
Mm.
So in addition to the Lyme disease, you're now actually or being injected with additional pathogen that will make your body more sick. And co-infections are a real problem. That's why I always tell that a single tick bite can actually cause multiple disease outcomes. And people really have to be careful about it. And unfortunately, yes, it's going to make it worse. Co-infections are a big thing, and it will make it worse.
So this begs the question, which I may have already asked you a few years ago, but I'm still very curious. Why are ticks such good vectors?
So I can compare, mosquitoes and ticks. Mosquitoes feed on a mammal just once in its life cycle, right? When it's an adult, it goes and feeds on a human or another mammal. It takes the blood, it flies off in 5 minutes, done, right? Ticks, on the other hand, there are three life cycle stages that requires blood meal. Larvae needs blood meal. Nymphal ticks need blood meal. Adult ticks need blood meal. So the ticks have more opportunity to receive a pathogen, right? Every time it feeds on a mouse or a squirrel or a human, if those animals carry the pathogen, this pathogen now enters the tick body. So it has three opportunities to get infected. So more opportunity to receive and more opportunity to give as well makes it a potent vector for disease-causing agents, right? That is one. Second, they're very resilient. They can stay attached to the human for 5 to 7 days. So it has enough time, window period, to transmit a pathogen. Like mosquitoes, I said, only 5 minutes, right? But here you have 7 days. There's plenty of time and plenty of pathogen is being continuously injected, right? It's not just a one bolus of inoculation. It is continuously injecting. And the ticks can survive longer outside without a blood meal for years. So that is another thing, right? Mm. So all these combinations make them a perfect vector to transmit disease-causing agents.
So ticks are not born infected, right? They have to contract it from whatever they bite.
So it is good for some pathogens like Lyme disease. When the female tick, if it is positive for the Lyme disease agent, when they lay thousands of eggs, the eggs are negative for Lyme disease agent. Wow. However, for the viruses, it's different.
Mm.
When the female tick is positive for the virus, when it lays the egg, a portion of the eggs can be positive. So it's not 100%, but I would say close to 5% to 10% of the egg mass that hatches into larvae, they are positive. So the ratio is less, but in the virus, yes, they can be, we call it transovarial transmission from mom to the offspring. It can happen for the viruses, but for other tick-borne bacterial pathogens, for Lyme disease, definitely not. But others, depending on what pathogen we talk about it, there is a minute percentage of that, but it's not a lot. But it still contributes to the overall perpetuation of the pathogen in nature.
So the mice and the squirrels and everything else that they're biting are just as much to blame, I guess, as if we want
Absolutely.
To cast blame.
Yeah. Absolutely. But it doesn't kill them. So they are perfect reservoirs. So we call it reservoir host, which means that it allows the pathogen to replicate, allows the pathogen to grow in its body to some level in such a way that when a tick feeds on them, it can acquire. But it doesn't do any harm to the mice.
Wow.
So they're very clever to kind of allow it to happen, but it doesn't kill. So it is a co-evolutionary process with the pathogen and the mammal because they have evolved millions of years like that, right? So we call it the perfect reservoir. So when there are more reservoirs like that in the nature, yeah, it's very difficult to control and limit. The only way I tell people to avoid getting, tick-borne disease is not having tick bites at all. That's it. That's the only way, no matter... I know that we don't have good vaccine. I know that we don't have good diagnostic assays. That is the nature of the science, right? That's nature of how we work. However, there's one thing we can do is to avoid getting tick bites. Do tick checks regularly. Plan yourself before you're going outdoor, doing an outdoor activity. Take some, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to prepare yourself before going outdoor. Have, tick spray. Make sure that your outdoor clothing is treated with permethrin. Carry your spray bottle with you. And then when you go trails, stay in the middle. Mm-hmm. Don't go to the edges of the trail because that's where deer ticks are waiting for you, right? And then we allow the pets to wander off the trails and then they come back. When they come back, it's high possibility that they will be having ticks on them. So we have to do tick checks on us and also on the pets as well. So it is that, I know it takes about 30 minutes of extra time, before and after doing an outdoor activity, but it actually saves you a good lifelong without a tick-borne disease. So unfortunately, yes, we have to do that.
And I guess the ticks aren't picky about their blood meal. They're just as happy with a mouse as a human.
Exactly. They're perfectly happy. They are opportunistic feeders. They will find any opportunity, find a mammal, and they will attach to it.
If we take the human emotion out of it, do you think, in all your experience studying ticks, that they serve some greater ecological purpose?
That's a great question. Actually, yes, in a way, because birds can actually use that, like, because they can actually peck on them and use that as a nutritional source because it has blood in them, right? And, you know, let's assume that a bird lands on a deer that is feeding on the deer. It now has concentrated blood, deer blood, in its belly. So when the bird eats them, it's a nutritious meal for them, like a protein bar for them. And chickens eat them, possums eat them. So the animals, they actually eat because they get nutrition, right? They get a protein nutrition. It's like, I call it a protein bar. So it's basically, you have seen a lot of pictures of a bird perching at, on the back of the, you know, elephants or other animals, like cleaning their body, right? So they are eating their parasites, what is on the body. So in a way, they are mutually helping to groom. But here, yes, by doing it, actually, it is a nutritious food for the birds. But that's only about the ecological significance, I can tell.
Yeah.
But in terms of anything else, I don't think it does anything.
I'll ask you a personal question you don't have to answer. Have you ever been affected by a tick-borne disease? You work so closely with them.
I have got a couple of tick bites in the past. Probably I may have developed a resistance to the tick bites. It's not that they don't bite on me. They do bite, but they don't. I do the tick check regularly, so I never allowed any tick, I would say, post a few hours on me. So, I mean, yes, I've been exposed, but fortunately, knock on the wood, at least to my knowledge, I don't have any tick-borne disease. But I must tell that I have a lot of experimental vaccines, I would say, as a tick researcher, because I work with a lot of dangerous viruses. So I do have a lot of vaccines in my body because I have to work in the BSL-4 with a particular virus. So I need to make sure that I have a vaccine for those viruses. Otherwise, I could expose myself and, you know, I could eventually die, right? So I know that I have a lot of immune response built over the time. And also, I've been constantly exposed in the field working with the ticks, which means that I may have acquired natural immunity. I know some people, field researchers, develop this over the time. But I know that it doesn't mean that I'm complacent, that I am resistant to tick bites. No, I do the same thing like what I preach others. Every time I do an outdoor activity, you know, I have a spray and my outdoor clothing socks. I keep separate shoes and socks for my outdoor activity that are permethrin treated every year, every spring. I do religiously. I've seen people suffering from Lyme disease, suffering from other tick-borne diseases, and Powassan virus. I have seen people personally, because, you know, I'm a Powassan virus researcher, and I've seen people suffering from the disease. So after seeing that personally, talking to people personally, I'm scared as well to get these tick bites to tick-borne disease as well. So I'm also very cautious. I do the same thing for my family members. I do this practice religiously. So, yes, you know, luckily, as of today, I don't have any tick-borne disease. But again, I don't know, you know, maybe I was an asymptomatic person, right? But I do, I've gotten tick bites, but I remove them as soon as possible.
And you've been able to get some experimental vaccines as a researcher. Do you think that those will ever be approved for the general populace?
I don't think so, because it carries a lot of risk. So eventually, they will get into the market. And sometimes, you know, we can get those vaccines that are available outside the United States, right? Like tick-borne encephalitis vaccine, you can actually go to a travel clinic and get it, but it is not mandated in America for that, right? So I think that you can go to Europe, you can go to Asia and get some vaccines that you wouldn't get it here. So sometimes I've done that as well. So I had to, the very first tick-borne encephalitis vaccine, I had to travel to Canada to actually get it, because at that time, no clinic in America was actually giving that vaccine. So I had to go to Canada, get the vaccine there and come back. And then another time, I had to send my lab people to Germany to get the vaccine. So I had to send two of my lab members to Germany to get that same vaccine. Because sometimes we do that because we work with those dangerous agents. So it is better that we get protected ourselves. And it's more of a preventive thing. But you know, getting tick bites is one, but then actually working with those dangerous viruses in a highly contained sterile laboratory is a different thing. So we had to protect ourselves very carefully on that. So, but we take every single measure. As you know, that we have a BSL-3 lab in our place here at Upstate. It's called Vector Biocontainment Laboratory, where we work with highly dangerous viruses. And we take every single precaution so seriously. So, you know, I used to work with in a BSL-4 lab in much more dangerous viruses with the spacesuit and everything, mm-hmm. with ticks and tick-borne viruses. So I come from a culture of safety, mm-hmm. Biosafety. So I don't work with BSL-4 anymore, but that training in me is still there. So when I came here to Upstate to build the biocontainment laboratory, I built it with the highest standards one could actually build. And then we performed the study with the highest biosafety standards. We trained the people to the best so that, everybody's safe and the environment is safe as well. You know, somehow the ticks are crawling out of the lab or anything like that. So we take utmost care on everything. So that's one reason I'm okay to recommend vaccine for people who work with, at least in this per se. Mm-hmm. But for the general public, I'm not sure. It's a lot of, if someone is spending a lot of outdoor activity, let's say in Africa or Europe, where these ticks are prevalent, their tick-borne virus is highly prevalent, then they have to talk to their healthcare provider to see is it really needed for them, because they are putting themselves at a risk in, let's say, Central Europe or Western Europe, where the tick-borne encephalitis is a major, major problem, and it has a high case fatality rate as well.
Wow. I didn't realize ticks were such a worldwide problem. I always just suspected it was us.
No, I think ticks are a global problem, actually. But the thing is that each area, each geographic part of the world has a different viral problem. Lyme disease is a little bit more present all over the world in a way. But the viruses are very focused. You know, if you go to Europe, you have tick-borne encephalitis. If you go to, North Africa, you have Crimean Congo and Southern Europe, you have Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. That's almost like Ebola. You know, when you get that infection, blood will be leaking out of all the orifices, and it's highly fatal, actually. And then you go to India, Southeast Asia, you have a virus called chiasmal forest virus, also called as monkey fever virus. And then if you go to Southeast Asia, the SFTS virus that I was mentioning, that Asian longhorn tick transmits, is there. That is devastating as well. So every part of the world has a different tick-borne virus problem. It is challenging. So it is global, actually. People don't realize it, but it is a global problem.
Amazing. So to wrap up here, Dr. Tongamani, how do you see your own research continuing to evolve? What are you most interested in understanding?
So we are trying to develop an early warning system based on our program, based on a lot of other data that we haven't published yet. It's actually going behind the scenes, where we can actually develop an early warning system for tick-borne diseases, but we are also developing an early warning system for general viral pathogens based on our work. It's so cool. And the other thing is that we are developing an anti-tick vaccine and also antivirus vaccine, antipovacin vaccine. So we are trying to develop this. I'm hoping that in 5 years' time, we may have a good candidate in such a way that it will repel the ticks when they feed on people. But we are trying to find a way to repel much faster, because the viruses are transmitted to the humans right away. Mm-hmm. So we have to find a way that ticks can repel or reject it from the bites much quickly. It may protect against Lyme disease, but I want it to also protect against viruses that are immediately transmitted. So hopefully in 5 years, we'll have that combination that rejects the tick, also it actually stops the virus from causing severe disease in humans. So we continue to march on these two pathways. One is actually providing an early warning system, and the other one is actually developing countermeasures for tick and tick-borne pathogens primarily.
That's fascinating. I think we need to continue to check in with you every few years and see how it's going. And that vaccine that you're developing seems really like it would be a very promising thing to repel the ticks on contact.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. I'm really happy to talk to you again.
A quick update on my dad. That test for anaplasmosis finally came back negative, and he was treated for a different virus altogether. I'm Brett Barry, and this is Cats Cast. Saturdays on Radio Catskill and online at catscast.com, home of the original podcast with a full episode archive, transcripts, and more. Thanks for joining us.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's oldest independent community bank, offering deposit and loan products for more than 110 years. Members FDIC and Equal Housing Lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. More information at jeff.bank. And from the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, dedicated to promoting the Sullivan County Catskills. SullivanCatskills.com. And from listeners like you.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.